everybody back to the second day of the conference. And to start the session this morning, we have Nick T. Berger from the University of Melbourne with the ongoing challenge of connecting speakers to archival language records.
Thanks very much. What I want to talk to you about today is one of the issues that we have is language archives. We don't have enough language archives. And the ones that we do are often difficult to access. And of course, particularly for the speakers of the languages. And this is becoming more of a problem as the scale of the documentation we're engaged in is increasing. There's obviously always this complicated role of archives. Are we colonial? Are we post-colonial? And I'll talk a little bit about that. But for archives, one of the big issues is to publicise what we have in ways that speakers can find what's in the collection. And the other side of that is using archives as a sort of source, but building local collections that are much more relevant to the local environment. So Nick Evans, in a recent article, says that it's becoming feasible to record around 500 hours of linguistic material in a couple of years of fieldwork because the equipment's becoming better all the kinds of data management and everything is getting worked out so that we're able to deal with all of this sort of material. But this means that we'll need more archives for this material. If we're recording 500 hours, that's in the order of a terabyte or so of material, if it's video and audio. So you can imagine for every fieldwork project, a terabyte, where is that going to be stored? So there are language archives around the world. This is the DELAMUN, Digital Endangered Languages and Music Archive Network membership. You can see where the dots are. Asia doesn't feature on this map because there aren't any dots there. There need to be. And then there's the Open Language Archives community, which has more members. This isn't all of their members. These are the ones with more sort of substantial linguistic content. So language archives are a good way of organising records. Often linguists will only organise their collection when they come to deposit it in an archive. Archives provide a citable form of language records, and of course that's really important for our new methodologies where we shouldn't be making claims without citing back to original data. They curate the records with licenses for use, again another really important factor, so that people don't have to come and ask the linguist every time for access to records. The language archives provide some kind of license which says how you can use the records. And of course they make the records available to source communities because they're all on the web and clearly licensed. But the real issue is that language archives are always under-resourced. The language archives we have are operating on string and chewing gum and really need much more resourcing. So this is just a group of the most productive, I suppose, language archives and the number of resources and the number of languages represented, just to give you an idea if you don't sort of realise what's going on out there. There are some that are very locally focused or particularly focused on an area. So ILA is Languages of Latin America, based in Texas. The ATNA, I won't even try pronouncing, the Regional Linguistic Archive. Again, you can see it has three distinct languages, but that's because what it focuses on is those three languages. And Paradisic, the archive that I work at, has a much broader remit, and we've got about 1,200 languages represented in the collection. So OLAC, which I just mentioned, fantastic resource that linguists have, and Gary Simons and Stephen Bird have put this together. And in it, this is a resource that harvests material, that metadata from language archives around the world every day. And if we put a new record into our catalogue today, it will be harvested by OLAC tonight or tomorrow. And then a page for every language in the world is created. So this is the language that I work on. If you put the three-letter code up here, the three-letter ISO 6393 code for the language, you will get a list of all the resources for each language that has a three-letter code. Fantastic resource. So Paradisic is, as I said, the archive that I work on, Pacific and Regional Archive for Digital Sources in Endangered Cultures. It's a collaborative project between three universities in Australia. It's now been going for 16 years, which isn't bad for a language archive. Ideally, it will last forever, but 16 years is pretty good. You can see the sort of area that most of our records come from. It is really focused on the Pacific and the region around Australia, but we do have records from all over the world because there aren't enough language archives, and we get material deposited from lots of places now. There are the stats, 1,200 languages, 489 collections, but 273,000 files. It's a significant data management issue to keep track of all of this stuff. Everything that's in there has rights associated with it, so depositors assign certain conditions to their collections. And the whole thing's around 55 terabytes at the moment. We feed to OLAC, so we have RSS type feeds, so OAI, PMH, and so on type feeds that OLAC picks up. So this is a way of publicising our collection. So the theme then is, how do people get access to our stuff? One way is that they can Google it because it's picked up by these feeds. So maximising the reach of our catalogue. We can get the records in our collection back to source communities. One way is to send hard disks to cultural centres, USB drives, but this relies on these centres having computers. If we want to send it back to people, often they don't have computers, so that's a bit of a problem. We always downsample whatever we have, so we have archival versions of files, which are very high resolution, but we automatically transcode everything down to low delivery versions, so MP3 from WAVE and JPEG from TIFF. And all of this goes along with making our catalogue as accessible and findable as we can. But the thing is, if you deliver a bunch of files to somebody, they don't necessarily have a lot of contextual information, which we'll look at in a minute. Now, there is a critique of language archives from the point of view of user interface, and this is one such critique, that most language archives are not meeting the needs of most users. I think we can obviously always do better, but as I said, we all operate on very tight budgets, and I think we're doing pretty well, actually. And I'm not that impressed with the kinds of critiques you get that sort of say that we are colonial expropriators of information. So here's another one. Archives have made explicit attempts to serve this community. However, the vast majority of these attempts have been top-down in nature, inspired by the archives' vision of the needs of these user communities. But I could say that another way of seeing this is that linguists are actually taking responsibility for returning materials, and that archives are returning materials to communities. We could sit around and not do it, and not worry about user interfaces, but in fact, I think archives are doing a pretty good job. Because in the past, we were always criticised for keeping the materials and not returning them to communities. So archives are turning this around. I would suggest archives are a post-colonial effort by linguists to return materials to communities. And again, the challenge is to design language archives that accommodate the needs of all user groups. It is a challenge, but in the meantime, archives continue to accession material and continue to make it available. So if somebody wants to work with us to improve the user interface, I think we'd all be happy to have them come and work with us. We have lots of experience of people finding records in our collections from even the most remote areas, using mobile phones typically. So here's an example. Here's Koitabu, which is a language of Papua New Guinea. If you search for Koitabu, the second page of Google, so Koitabu has a lot of hits on its own. You can see it's the name of a political sort of grouping as well. But the second page of Google gives you the OLAC resources for Koitabu here. And then the speaker of Koitabu found material and then wrote this testimonial to us saying how excited he was to find material with his ancestors. The feeling of knowing that the language has been documented, recorded in a structured way, kept safely somewhere in the world, hearing it spoken 50 to 60 years ago and by some people you haven't seen but whose names you only hear in history, etc., is quite incredible. Most heartwarming, and so on. So these kinds of testimonies obviously are very motivating for us, but I think they do show that speakers of languages can find information in our collection. So one of the big problems for a lot of archives is that our interfaces are in English only. The exception is the Archive of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America, who have a client group, if you like, which is Spanish-speaking, so they can build a Spanish and an English version, which they have. But for many other archives, we have too many languages. Paradisiac has 1,200 languages. We're not going to build interfaces that can cope with that. The Cocoon archive in France is French only. The Pangloss archive is French and English, and our archive, Paradisiac, is English only. As I said, we provide low-resolution copies, again, to make things accessible. It's not, you can't deliver the high-resolution versions to over the web. But we also built, for example, this is a... I'll just play this. So what you're looking at is a viewer that we built for Elan files. So if you put an Elan file and a transcript in our collection, it will automatically put up this viewer and play it to you. So this is a JavaScript viewer, which is available on GitHub if anybody wants to get it, but there are a number of different viewers now for Elan anyway. But again, this is trying to make these files accessible so that somebody doesn't find an Elan file in our collection and just look at a bunch of XML, right? That's one other way of making information accessible in the collection. We also publicise the collection in various ways. Facebook is a good way. And publicity in general, hopefully, will lead people to look in the collection and also to help find items that need to be accessioned into the collection. Here's another thing to listen to. So what you're looking at there is a landscape where each of the shards of light coming up from the ground is a language. And these are snippets from our collection. And as you travel through, you're traveling through a forest of languages hearing sounds. Now, I presented on this earlier, ICLDC, you might have seen it. And while it's sort of a cute idea, it's got a huge amount of publicity. And that's great because then it brings people to the collection to look for materials. So that's a newspaper from Papua New Guinea. And there's an article from a magazine as well. So this is another way of doing publicity to get people, and also a way of exposing what's in the collection. Because audio on its own is very difficult to navigate. You have to sit there and listen in real time. So this is giving you little snippets of what's in the collection. One of the problems for delivering items to communities is that, you know, we've got a collection, as I say, that's a bit out of date, but we've got lots of files. If we just want to extract, you know, four items from our collection and deliver them to a community, the ones that are relevant to their particular community, and we have, you know, maybe 30 files, the problem is that the catalogue is separated from the files. So what can we do about that? You don't want to give people a file dump like this. I mean, you can, and they might be happy with it because they'll go and listen to it and they're interested in it. But it's not the best way to do it. So at Paradisiac, what we've always done is for any item in the collection, every time the catalogue is saved, an XML file is written into the item. So this is the XML file, and this is the item. So the item, you can see, is stored as a WAV and an MP3 file, but it has an XML file with it, which is self-describing. So each item in the collection, in a directory or a folder or whatever, has its own description, which means that even if all the items in the collection are separated from the catalogue, they're still able to be described, and you can reconstitute the catalogue from those XML files. So, we built a downloader which harvests the information in these files. So you can make an arbitrary collection of items in our collection. The downloader tool that we have harvests all of those and creates a mini catalogue of just those items. And we can then give that to people. So we'd already built that JavaScript that you saw, which had the Elan viewer. So we just took that and repurposed it to build sub-collections of Paradisiac. And that is now a viewer of just whatever items we create in the sub-collection. And we built this, and I'll show it to you in a second. And we tested it, and then in addition to the normal items in our catalogue, one of the users said we'd like to have genre. So for a Western Desert Aboriginal community, they wanted particular genres of stories. So we were able to add genre as a term in one of the fields of our catalogue that we don't use much. And we made sure that it was only used for genre, and then we could export that, and we could include genre as one of the ways of browsing this material. And there's a link to that data loader. So there's genre is added into our comments, and these are local terms. So Jilgugu and Mirpa are locally relevant terms, so that when we build our little viewer, we can use these terms. Now, we built all of this to be delivered on a Raspberry Pi. Raspberry Pi is a little unit like this. It's actually a computer. It costs about $100. And it's also a Wi-Fi transmitter. So with this, we can download all of the material we want. It's got four USB ports, so it can actually have lots and lots of storage on it. And it can be a local transmitter of the collections that we have created. So this is a really interesting way of delivering material. Because most people now are accessing the web and other things on their mobile phones. This is Port Vila in 2012, and there are about 80% coverage of mobile phones, even in Papua New Guinea. So even in the highlands of Papua New Guinea and quite remote areas of the Pacific, people have mobile phones and can access the internet. Of course, the internet costs a lot of money. So using Raspberry Pi means you're creating a local network. There's no bandwidth issue, and there's no cost. So here are people in Iroquois Village in Vanuatu looking at materials in their own language that came out of Paradisec. And we've tested this in Tahiti and in the Western Desert in Australia as well. So I think this is quite an exciting way of delivering material back to communities. But I think in the end, archives really require local intermediaries, so archives like ours. So if you're a local archive, like the ATNA archive, you're immediately connected with the community that you're working with. But archives like Paradisec probably require some other agency, like a local cultural centre, to host something like a Raspberry Pi. We can keep sending them USB sticks, they can put them into the Raspberry Pi, and they can keep delivering that material locally. I think if people can navigate Google, then they're probably going to find records in their language. And really, once anybody's started using the internet, and I think, you know, really, most people with access are able to Google and find information, as you saw from that Koitabu example, then they can also most likely negotiate the interface of some, if not all, of the language archives. And for those who are unable to search the web, local agencies can present archival information in more relevant ways. So, yeah, that's where the Raspberry Pi can sit and broadcast for phone users. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you like me to moderate your questions, or do you want to do it yourself?
I can do it.
Okay,
thanks.
Do we have time for questions?
Yep. Actually, you could take a mic up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can just pull it out of there. Yeah.
My question is, thank you very much, Masicho, for your fine presentation and all your work that you're doing to preserve our native language throughout the land and the world. And my question is, we really need all of these recordings so that we could, we call it the Ginji Kutunjat Kitlirohonjasho. Let's not leave our language because these are our first speaking language people who spoke the language, and we don't want to change anything. So it's good to have it open, and every the descendants and the native people would learn from their elderly speakers. But how do we protect that from other people who may want to pirate or steal the information, use the information for their own uses? And how do we keep it open but yet protect that from other people who will misuse that information?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In my experience, very few people want to listen to recordings in other languages. There are, of course, terrible examples. The Deep Forest example from the Solomon Islands, where a song that was in an archive was taken by a company and produced as a lullaby. It was a lullaby from the Solomon Islands, and it was produced and made a lot of money as a hit song. And, you know, that company got into a lot of trouble, and it's a very famous case. And, you know, in the end, it's a real balance. If you decide that you want to lock things up on the off chance that somebody might misuse it, then, as you say, you and your descendants won't have access to that material. So we put licenses on everything which say how you can use it. If people abuse those licenses, then there is a legal remedy. You can take them to court. In some parts of the world, there's a moral rights are asserted. I think America doesn't have moral rights. So there are legal ways of putting a legal barrier around this material being misused. But if people want to do bad things, they will do bad things. And I think from our perspective, we don't build things from the perspective of somebody doing bad things with material. We do it from the perspective of people treating the material respectfully and doing the right thing with it. So I suppose that's perhaps not a complete answer, but it's my answer.
I would like to make a very short comment to this question, because if recording belongs only to some researcher and he is not distributed at all, it's very difficult to prove that it's his recording when stolen. But if it's in archive with his name, so it's very easy to prove that it's stolen.
Yep.
So it's very important thing for arguing with people who do not want to put the recordings to the archives.
Yeah, thank you, yes.
What different levels of access do you consider important?
We basically have two levels of access, open and closed. And the closed have conditions on them. So that's it.
What sort of conditions?
Oh, well, people put conditions like, close for 5 years while I'm working on it, basically, people should contact the researcher first before they, or the researcher or Paradisic, so they want some sort of mediated access. All the material in Paradisic is only available to registered users, so you have to have registered your email address first. It's very lightweight, before you can download material. So I suppose there are three levels of access. One is you can look at stuff but not actually download it, and then when you become a registered user, you have to look at what the conditions are that the user has applied.
First, I want to thank you for the work that you've been doing, and it's wonderful to see how it's developed over the years. Do you have any data on how the material that's being used is being used? One of the things that Doug Whalen and I did over the last couple of years, it's 2 years old now, is to survey linguists to see how, if they were using these archives and how they were using. And it was actually very small.
Yeah. I think the most use is coming from speakers, not from linguists. People are downloading material for sentimental reasons, and maybe for language revitalization purposes, relearning songs, that kind of thing. But unfortunately, no, I don't have a lot of data because we don't really track what happens after people download material from the collection.
Thanks again, Nick, for a great presentation. I was just curious to hear your thoughts. You noted that there were a few areas on the map where there were not dots, where there were finds archives missing. I wonder if you'd be able to comment on that. Why do you think that is? Why certain regions either don't have archives right now or are potentially more resistant to the introduction of language archives?
I don't know if they're resistant. It's just that it's you really need some people that are dedicated and will keep working to make the archive. I think all the Delamont archives do a bit of outreach work and will go places and try and help people. And I've worked in the Pacific, French Polynesia, trying to get people there to build an archive. They're interested. I was just in India before I came here, and people in Northeast India are very interested in building an archive. But being interested and doing it are sort of two different things. And also, if you get into the hands of computer scientists, you don't necessarily end up with a language archive. You end up with something strange. like a database or something like that. That's not necessarily... So language archives are quite interesting in the liminal zone between being a sort of just a repository but also having all of this responsive front-facing interface. And then there's OLAC as well. So all of that, I think, goes to making a language archive. But, if you're from a place that doesn't have dots on the map, there are lots of us around who'd be quite happy to help to get language archives in other parts of the world.
I'm really fascinated by the use of the Raspberry Pi for deploying these materials to remote communities. So if I understood correctly, at the moment, one thing you do with them is you put the downsampled versions of the files on it, and then you serve them with a web server over Wi-Fi using the Elan player that you developed separately for Paradise. Is that right?
Sort of. The Elan player is just one part of the. So there's actually it's a viewer, a file viewer, and it knows what each file type is and presents those files in the way appropriate to those files. So Elan file is just one, but if it's a PDF, it will present it with a PDF viewer. So, yes.
Okay, great. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how successful that's been in engaging community members and whether you have any ideas for something that might be even more engaging that would unlock the potential of this delivery model.
Yeah. So initially, as I said, this is a Raspberry Pi. There was another unit called Library Box, which you may be familiar with, which was self-powered. So these aren't self-powered. These have to be plugged into the mains power. And we've only ever tested this when we go to a place and try running it while we're there. We haven't left it in a particular community yet, but that's the next step to do that. And we had to build all of this infrastructure, so the data loader and the way of extracting the information. But that's all there now, and so we're really ready to leave these in communities and then, you know, find out how people use it. But the great thing is you just have to have a phone, come in range of the Wi-Fi, and then you can access the material.
Is your code for the Raspberry Pi open source?
Yes, everything's on GitHub, and the link was there, so yes. Yep. And the instructions for how to build a Raspberry Pi too, because you actually have to build them. Yep. We're not in that business. You'll have young people who can do that kind of thing.
How much for that?
$100. Okay.